You are listening to the Tour des Flâneurs, the cycling podcast at the 2022 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapien, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Stage 18, today we're in Hautacam.
François, last night we were in no doubt who the best two riders in the race were. Tonight we're probably in no doubt who the best two riders in the race were, but it's two different riders, Jonas Vingegaard and Wout van Aert. What a display by Jumbo Visma today.
Yeah, it was really, really, really impressive. It might have, not gone as planned. I mean, they started the day extremely well with Christophe Laporte, leading the way on the flat. Well, the bit of flat there was on the stage today. Then Nathan van Hooijdonk took over. And then, of course, from the very beginning, they sent Wout van Aert up front. The man is the team director, Christian Yeoman calls the Green Monster. So up the road. And well, until then, you could tell, okay, the rocket is launched, but will the last, flight of it will go all the way? And it went even better than we could expect. I guess probably the plan was to protect the yellow jersey from the attacks of Tadej Pogacar, but not only did they protect the jersey, but also they launched the final rocket, the one that hit the target very, very hard today at the top of Hautacam, with Jonas Vingegaard dropping Tadej Pogacar, kind of a humbling Tadej Pogacar. And as much as yesterday was Brendan McNulty's day, he was the man who created the illusion that maybe that there was a glimpse of hope for Pogacar today, Jumbo's destruction of Pogacar was total.
Well, yes, François. I mean, I described the Wout van Aert move, which has been a feature of this Tour de France, hasn't it? Jumbo-Visma have sent him up the road a lot of times in the mountain stages, almost as a kind of an advance party, kind of checking out whether there's, habitable conditions on Hautacam for Jonas Vingegaard. And then it performs the purpose and the function of a sort of almost a protective bubble for Vingegaard when they eventually catch up. And it worked a treat today. Jumbo-Visma, they did look a bit vulnerable yesterday, but, well, we kind of alluded to it yesterday. Were they treating today as the more difficult and the more serious stage? But it does look, after stage 18 of the Tour de France, from Lourdes to Hautacam, that, barring disasters, Jonas Vingegaard will win the Tour de France now. It was a show of strength from Jumbo-Visma exactly when it mattered. And they cracked Pogacar for the second time in the race. Vingegaard has won his second stage, and he's become the second Dane to win the stage that looks like it will seal the yellow jersey on Hautacam, because that's exactly what Bjarne Riis did in 1996, although that's probably not a comparison Jumbo-Visma or Vingegaard will particularly welcome. But the lead now, 3 minutes 26. I mean, it would take some kind of physical and mechanical meltdown in Rocamadour for that to be overturned now. But what an interesting stage it was as well, because so much happened. It kind of fitted the same pattern as yesterday with a big group of riders. I think 33 riders went away. All but 4 of the teams were represented in it. And the lead wasn't allowed to go too far. So it was always in play all day. And so when the GC race kicked off on the second of those 3 really big climbs, the Col de Spandel, we just knew that Vingegaard and Pogacar were going to cut their way through the group like a hot knife through butter. François has just popped a savoury snack in his mouth. No crunching on the mic, please. No clattering on the table. I can't eat a savoury snack now, can I? I'm in the middle of the tail of the attack. And then it was a question of who can hold on to the coattails of Vingegaard and Pogacar. And, well, the answer was, for a lot of the time, no one. There was a lot of drama as well, because on that middle climb, Pogacar attacked. Vingegaard was equal to it immediately, and the pair of them went away from everybody else. And on the way down the descent, Pogacar really pushed it, and there was a very dicey moment for Vingegaard where his back wheel skipped and it looked like he might lose it. But then, irony of ironies, a few kilometres later, it was Pogacar who skidded and ended up in the grass ditch. And then we had perhaps a pedaleur de charme moment, because Vingegaard waited, Pogacar got back up to him, and they shook hands before resuming hostilities. A lot else was going on up the road, because going into the bottom of the final climb to Hautacam, the 3 leaders from the original break were Thibaut Pinot, Wout van Aert and Dani Martinez. behind, Vingegaard and Pogacar were joined by Benoot, Kuss, and some of the other GC riders. Geraint Thomas got back on, having briefly been up the road, in fact, earlier on the climb. The other riders up there were Madouas, Louis Menkes, Hugo Uhl, who were, you know, variously either trying to get away in the original break or made moves a bit later on. So on the final climb, Wout van Aert actually attacked the other two. Martinez was able to stay with him, but Pino was cooked at that point. But that wasn't the end of Groupama FDJ's day, was it? Because Madouas and Godu were working really, really well together. They had a plan, and it worked to get David Godu up to fourth place overall. Sepp Kuss rode, well, he did a Brandon McNulty today, didn't he? They caught Van Aert, and as soon as they did, Kuss peeled off, and then Van Aert led in his green jersey. He led Vingegaard in the yellow jersey, with Pogacar in the white jersey clinging on. And then, well, Vingegaard cracked Pogacar with around 3.6 kilometres to go, and that was that. Incredible stuff, really, and no doubt that Vingegaard deserves to win the Tour de France on the basis of his climbing. Overall, it's Vingegaard now 3 minutes 26 ahead of Pogacar, Thomas now at 8 minutes, Godu, as I said, up to 4th, then Quintana, Menkes, Vlasov, Bardet, who's kind of playing a snakes and ladders Tour de France here, he went down a couple of places, Alexei Lutsenko, very much the Zabeldia prize for him, because he's snuck into the top 10. He's now 9th. Adam Yates is 10th. And the other thing about today is that Jumbo-Visma hold the three big jerseys. Vingegaard in yellow, Van Aert in green, of course, and now Vingegaard, poor Simon Geschke. He's had to concede the polka dot jersey, and very little chance that he will get that back. But he will wear it still, because Vingegaard is in yellow. Three more riders out with COVID, Chris Froome, Emanuele Aviti and Damiano Caruso. And I make that 15 riders out of the Tour who have actually said it's because of COVID, plus a number of others who are ill. But what a humdinger of a stage. But we started the day in Lourdes, my favourite town in France. And we'll hear Francois and I in Lourdes around about lunchtime today.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapien. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insight, and personalized analytics. We are here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens, the title sponsors of the Cycling Podcast. Their glucose monitoring technology, well, it may well have had a part to play in Jumbo-Visma's Tour de France, because Jumbo-Visma are one of the teams that use Super Sapiens, although they can't use it in the Tour itself because the technology is not sanctioned by the UCI, but they do use it in training, and I gather it's revolutionised the way that they fuel for training and racing. Super Sapiens have started a podcast of their own, and in the third episode, the head of applied science at Super Sapiens, Dr. Howard Zisser, has been talking about the technology, and he also basically answers the question that everyone has when they first put the sensor on the arm and start looking at their glucose data. What should we be looking for?
People put it on, they're looking, it's like, that's my glucose? I'm like, yeah, that's your glucose. Wait a minute. And you'll see your next glucose, and your next glucose, and your next glucose. The first response is you like, that's so cool. And then their second response is like, is it normal? If you don't have diabetes, yeah, it's probably normal. What I tell people to do is almost do nothing at first. See what your baseline is. See what happens first thing in the morning. Like, your glucose a little high in the morning? Is it low? What happens with food if you change the order of your carbohydrates and fat? If you change the size? If you change the time of day, if you change it in relation to your exercise and all these things, what happens with sleep? So there's exercise and food is not the only thing that can affect your glucose. There's many things.
Well, Francois, I'm going to try to be positive about Lourdes. I'm going to admit that it is not my favorite place in France by a long chalk. But am I wrong to look rather unfavorably on Lourdes? We're here nestled amid the Pyrenees. It should be lovely, and there are some phenomenal things here. I mean, the Basilica is stunning, but there's also a sense that the town itself has, well, it's stuck in a sort of 1960s, 1970s time warp, and not to put too fine a point on it, it's a bit tacky in places, isn't it?
Yeah, it's rather kitsch or camp or whatever you want to call it. It's unfortunately, with all the due respect to, you know, Catholicism and religion as general and what the people believe in, obviously, you know, a lot of the shopkeepers in the center of Lourdes make a living out of, you know, the miracle and the appearances of the Virgin Mary. It is possible to feel a little bit uneasy about it and uncomfortable with all the, all the merchandising, you know, around completely valid faith. And but the thing is, that actually the tour being on, you know, with all the buses and the tour village, on the parvis, on the esplanade in front of the Basilica, it kind of fits in well together, because we are all bicycle lovers and lovers of the sport, and also we can resent the kind of most commercial aspect of it. Like, you know, if you've been close to the Village Départ, you know what it is: sponsors, plastic bottles of water given away, all this sort of wine, food, and all that. The kind of religion of cycling is treated by Le Tour sometimes, you know, it's gigantic, it's too much, it's a little bit, we can feel uneasy about it, about the grandeur of it. Well, Lourdes is in a way the same thing, you know, towards faith. Like, you know, humility should be the key to be a champion in cycling or in any field of society. Humility is a great part of the Christian faith, I guess. I'm not a very religious person. But if when you go to Santiago de Compostela, for instance, that's also a great place of faith and belief, and you know, with lots of pilgrims. Even the architecture is, which is of course 17th century classical style, and the way the faith is expressed by, you've got these little streets with bodegas where you drink in, you know, in bowls. Well, quite good white wine, actually. Is the fervor is different, and I wouldn't say more respectable, because I'm not saying Lourdes is not respectable, and everybody is respectable in their beliefs. Even the architecture of the Basilica sometimes looks a little bit like you're a Disney to me. But I mean, once again, whatever, you know, if it's good, you know, if people really feel the need to come here and achieve something, you know, spiritual for that's fine by me. I just, like you, feel a little bit uncomfortable, the same as I feel uncomfortable in the Village Départ of the Tour, where sometimes, you know, VIPs are more important than the riders.
Yeah, I think with Lourdes, I mean, I've been here many times and I've made a point of trying to avoid it in terms of where we stay on the tour, because I've not had terribly happy experiences here. I've never really found anywhere nice to stay or anywhere nice to eat. It's almost as if, in a commercial sense, there's this sense of almost exploitation of people's belief. It veers too far into that for me. The main street here with all of the souvenir shops is beyond tacky. I'm not saying that there's not a place for, you know, nice religious mementos, but you can buy holy water in the sort of heavy-duty bottles that you normally buy windscreen wiper fluid in, 10 litres of holy water. That doesn't seem to me to be I mean, maybe I'm being a little bit over the top, but it's kind of a sense of the exploitation. The hotels aren't any better because they don't need to be any better. The restaurants aren't any better because they don't need to be any better, because people are coming anyway, because Lourdes is a very holy place. And yeah, like I say, the Basilica, the grotto, fine. But everything that has grown up around it and just kind of stayed stuck in this, even the signage on all of the hotels and the shops on the main street here, they look like they haven't been renewed since about 1973. And it gives you a kind of downbeat feeling, really, rather than an uplifting one. And so I'm never terribly comfortable here. And I declare my non-interest in any organised religion quite happily. It's not an anti-religion sentiment, it's just an anti-Lord sentiment, really.
Yeah, I have an anecdote about staying in Lourdes when you're on the tour. I was staying in a hotel, can't remember the name of it, and I'm not going to give it anyway. But the mattress was very, very thin, and so I didn't have a very good night. And when in the morning I went down to the desk to check out, and the guy asked me if I had a good night, I said, well, not really, because the mattress was very thin. And the guy replied that that's what the pilgrims require, because, you know, you need, well, especially, you know, the humility I was talking about, you know, because you if you sleep too comfortably, you get too far away from God or whatever, which would seem to be a very lame excuse for a bad mattress, you know, but there you are. So, yeah, so some... How would you say, the merchants of the temple or something? It's that sometimes you have the impression some guys here, they're not the only ones. I mean, I said how much I hated ski resorts, some of the ski resorts in the Alps, for the same reasons, you know. The mountains are marvelous, are great places, and, you know, it's good for your health. Altitude is fine. Eating a frozen pizza for 20 euros at the top of a mountain in a building, in a lousy building built in the 1970s is not great. And I think sometimes Lourdes is a little bit like that, but I heard this morning from a very good source that apparently the riders have access to the Basilica from the paddock. You know, those who wanted to spend a moment to share, you know, their faith in that spot before, you know, embarking on the stage to Otakam. There was actually, in spite of the race bubble, a channel, you know, between barriers had been put into place for the riders to go into the Basilica and pray if they wanted to. I don't know if any one of them did, but apparently that's what was planned.
Interesting. I mean, Tadej Pogacar needs a miracle of sorts today, doesn't he? Perhaps he'll be tempted to go into the Basilica for a quiet moment. Did any of the riders go into the Chapel of Confession just across the other side of the start village? I don't know. Maybe certainly 2006, 2007, when the tour, whenever it came here in that era, plenty of riders could have queued up to confess their sins in there. My kind of favourite anecdote about the tour and Lourdes is a Sean Kelly story when we were working together on his book a number of years ago now. He told me about the one and only day he took the yellow jersey. It was in 1983, and he'd spent a week basically chipping away at Kim Anderson's advantage day by day, getting closer and closer. And then on the run into Po, Sean Kelly took the yellow jersey by a single second. And his very good friends, Herman and Elise Nies, who were the Belgian family who effectively adopted him. For many years during his career, Sean lived in the outskirts of Brussels with the Nies family. And Herman and Elise came to watch for a few days in the Pyrenees. And Sean gave the bouquet of flowers that he got on the podium to Herman and Elise. And they took them to the grotto to say a little prayer. And as Sean said, it didn't really do him a lot of good, because the next day the race went over four or five big mountains on its way to Luchon. So what would it have gone over? It would have gone over the Tourmalet, the Aubisque, the Aspin, the Perisord. He lost about 10 minutes and lost the yellow jersey. His one and only day in yellow. And a sad story about that yellow jersey too, because he took it off, he folded it up in his luggage with the race number still on. And when the tour reached Paris, someone had delivered his own car to Paris so he could get back home, and he put his bag into the back of the car, parked it, went for a meeting with a man called Daniel Doucet, who was the kind of the chief fixer of all the post-tour criteriums in those days, the man who set the fees for the riders, and he went to discuss basically his programme of post-tour criteriums and how much money he was going to get for racing. And when he came back to the car, somebody had smashed the window and stolen his luggage. And although he got his bag back from the French police a day or so later, the yellow jersey was gone. So Sean Kelly does not own the one and only yellow jersey with his race numbers on from the 1983 Tour de France.
Maybe it was a lesson in humility, and that was done precisely on purpose. I mean, you know, taking a candle to a grotto, you know, brought Sean back down to where we all are, fragile human beings.
Well, Francois, no miracle for Tadej Pogacar today. He obviously didn't visit the Basilica, did he?
No, yeah, he could have, or maybe he did, you know, like on the basis, I mean, if he had the same effect on him as it had on Sean Kelly at the time, that might be an explanation. The thing I think really today was, we really thought, because of Pogacar's utter domination for the past two Tours de France, that he had a hunger knock on Granon last week, and something wrong had happened. What seems to be the case today is that actually it's probably not Pogacar who faltered. It just, you know, was against a rider that's been the best man in the bunch, and it was just slightly better than he is. So what we thought last week was maybe, you know, a bad day, a moment of, you know, a sudden moment of weakness from Pogacar was actually probably not the case. It was just that Jumbo-Visma as a whole and Jonas Vingegaard in particular were just better than Pogacar this year.
Yeah, not just better physically, but today they did have a plan, didn't they, clearly? Because whereas yesterday they were a little bit missing in action, today they took the stage by the scruff of the neck. And this move, putting Wout van Aert up the road in the mountains, I mean, today he even surprised me with how strong he was on the climb at Oetekam. I mean, he was sprinting. When they finally distanced Pogacar, it was like a sort of Tour of Flanders winning sprint, wasn't it?
There was a time when I thought, and I told you, he's going to win the last four stages of the Tour de France. I mean, last year he won Ventoux. Today he finished third in the stage, and actually had he been a little bit more, I mean, saved his energy a little bit more, he might have been really not in contention probably with Vingegaard. Who knows? He looked really like a man with the legs and the ability to win a stage like this. And let's face it, I mean, we'll talk about it later, but, you know, with probably a sprint stage tomorrow, then the time trial, he won the last time trial last year in the Tour de France, and Paris, which he won last year as well. I mean, you know, really, what Van Aert gave the impression that he couldn't win anything, which raises the questions we ask ourselves again before, even last year. The question is on everybody's lips now. Is Wout van Aert a future, a possible GC contender in the Grand Tour? And I don't know what the answer to that is, but from what we saw today, leaning towards yes.
I mean, I'm not sure about that, but I mean, he has won a stage over Mont Ventoux before. The way he climbed today was exceptional. It wasn't just the tempo he was riding when he was in the break. I mean, he dropped Thibaut Pinot. I know Pinot, my heart almost broke yesterday when he said that he was no good. But he did make Pinot look fairly average. I mean, Pinot at the bottom of Oetekam was, I thought, going quite well. It looked like he was maybe trying to wind things up a bit, to whittle it down maybe to him and Martinez. Perhaps that was his thinking. But I mean, he got completely caught out when Van Aert went to the front.
Even Danny Martinez was humble. Like, we had the impression we had those kind of riders, you know, who go up the road to show that their jersey because they belong to a smaller team. But it was Thibaut Pinot and Danny Martinez, guys who have won big World Tour races, you know. They were really humbled by a guy who's supposed to be a cyclocross sprinter. I mean, everything but a high mountain specialist. So, yeah, really, once again, what an outstanding performance. When we look back on the Tour and, you know, and when we, like most riders, take it day by day in retrospect and look at what Wout van Aert has achieved in this Tour de France, wow.
Wow, indeed. It does make me think, I wonder, these historical comparisons never quite work, but I have this sense that Van Aert is a sort of rider from yesteryear. You know, if he was in the Eno era, or, you know, maybe the Merckx era, or before the Merckx era, he perhaps would have had more chance in the Tour de France, but the Tour de France has now become so sort of specialist, the final few kilometres of these climbs, the intensity and the pace is what it's all about. But today I think we saw a little glimmer that he could potentially do that.
It's one of the reasons why this Tour de France was exciting from day one. I'm very happy to, you know, come to a stage in my life as a Tour de France follower, that, you know, cycling gets exciting again, that things happen in the stage. The stage is not controlled by the team, you know, all day, you know, riding at the front, and the others looking resigned to second place, third place, fourth place. There's action everywhere, you know, up the road. Guys, as you say, you mentioned Gaudu fighting for fourth place. There are real fights within fights inside the peloton. We've had these years with stereotyped cycling, which was actually pretty boring. You know, remember the Froome years? Nothing against Chris Froome, who pulled out today, but in his days, you know, he won the first mountain stage, and that was it. You know, it was not the case this year, and because you know, my impression is that the age of power meters and all riders, you know, looking at their figures between the handlebars instead of, you know, following their instincts, that I think that age, you know, the age of power meters has gone, And a rider like Wout van Aert seems to be trusting more his instincts, his feeling for the race than his figures, and which is I think what cycling is all about. It should be about feeling, about the experience you have of the race, what you feel of, you know, the feeling of the race itself. You know what's going on. You know what, where the action is. That's what matters much more than equipment.
And I think another significant factor is the length of the mountain stages. I mean, it does feel like the 200-kilometer long mountain stage is dead. You know, they're just, yeah, there have been the sort of lumpier stage. I think the stage in one of the stages that was predominantly in Switzerland was close to 200 kilometers. But when you look at even the stage to Planche des Belles Filles, and considering most of that was kind of, you know, flat before they got to the bottom of the climb, that was 176 kilometers. The one to Megève, 148, Col de Granon, 151. Alpe d'Huez 165, and then these two big stages in the Pyrenees yesterday was 129 and today 143, and so it does lend itself to much more intense racing, explosive racing. Teams can make these risks, and it's not just about the teams making the risks of putting riders up the road, as we've seen these last 2 days. That because it's short, the group behind doesn't let the gap go too far. But also isn't too frightened to let serious GC contenders go up the road. We've seen, you know, Vlasov, we've seen Lutsenko, we've seen Menkes, who was at one stage fourth overall on the road today. We've seen the kind of shuffling of the pack from fourth to tenth. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, maybe this is just my, you know, memory cheating me, but it did feel like when you got to the second range of mountains, barring an absolute collapse, the GC was top 10 was kind of set, and everyone just rode round to Paris in the same order. And we just don't seem to have that now.
As a result as well, the speed is absolutely amazing. I mean, Wout van Aert might be another factor for that, you know, the way he rides, but everybody seems to be riding at their limits. And the average speeds we've seen on most stages, either on the flat or in the mountains, possibly because they're shorter, is unprecedented. And it's too early to tell whether this.
I think that's Wout van Aert just going back to the hotel.
That's right. Yeah.
I should clarify, no allegation that there's any kind of motorbike involved. Let me just be really clear about that.
It was simply the village idiot. I mean, there's one in every town in France. Every time we go in a small square like this, you've got a guy with his motorbike whose only sole aim in life is to be noisy. You know, I don't know. I mean, there are special kind of persons, and unfortunately, or fortunately, or whatever you want. I mean, this kid was here today as we were recording. No, I mean the average, it's too early to tell that this is going to be the fastest tour ever. But that's probably going to be the case.
I mean, let's talk about some of the things that are contributing to that, because it is an accumulation of factors that will have led to that. The bikes, the equipment, the clothing even. I mean, I always look back at even pictures from 2012. Team Sky, who was supposedly were over every detail. When you look at the jerseys that Wiggins and Froome were wearing back then, they were, you know, thicker material, they were baggier. They're in the speed suits every day now, even in the mountain stages, especially in the mountain stages. And people may scoff at that and say, oh, well, I see, it's clothing and equipment and nutrition. But clearly, there has been, you know, pretty dramatic strides. I mean, I remember when we were in Brussels, Francois, and Jonathan Vaughters was telling us about a particular tyre that was worth 10 or 15 watts on its own. And so the teams and the bike manufacturers, they have looked at all of these areas. And I think also the shorter stages and, well, yesterday, the tailwind leading into the Aspin would have been a factor. But the intensity of the racing, you know, they can race really, really hard when the stages are around the 4 hour mark. Yep. And they're not going into that real kind of deep, deep endurance. It's almost like it's changed the Tour de France from a 10,000 meters race to a 1500 meters race.
I think there's another factor, and which is very important in all sports, but it is becoming even more important in cycling these days, is TV. The format of stages is shorter because it's used TV better, and the fact that everything's shown live from the flag to, from the gun until the finish, means that, you know, riders can't afford to, you know, ride leisurely for 2 hours without nothing happening. Otherwise, you know, well, all our friends at Eurosport, GCN, SBS, ITV, name them, or France Television would be very unhappy. So the riders really have to show their jersey and attack from the gun. But also, there's another factor. We've seen in recent years in Grand Tours that breakaways go all the way very often, which means that there's a real struggle to get into the break, which can last for like 2 hours, and which means that, you know, the pace of the race while everybody's going to join the break is often close or over 50 kph, which makes a difference as well. So all these factors put together, I know that there'll be, you know, eyebrows will raise, you know, among some of you, and eyebrows do raise from time to time. I don't know whether there are other factors, you know, dubious factors about it, but anyway, everything we mentioned points to a faster Tour de France.
Well, we ought to talk about the likely winner, Jonas Vingegaard, and we'll do that in the next part.
Why have I asked my HVAC guy I found on Angie.com to change my grandpa's trachea tube? Because I was so amazed by how quickly he replaced our air ducts. I knew I could trust him to change Pop-Pop's tube while I was on vacation.
Make it quick, young man.
Aw, see? Pop-Pop trusts you.
I think we should call a doctor.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
Over time, moss, mold, and mildew stains cover your home, and cleaning them is too much work. You need Wet and Forget, the easy bleach-free way to clean tough outdoor stains. For decks, patios, and cushions, use Wet and Forget outdoor spaces. No scrubbing, no rinsing. Just apply and let it do the work for you over time. Got a bigger job? Reach second-story siding and roofs with Outdoor Max. Up to a 30-foot reach and 2x the coverage. Get Wet and Forget at Home Depot, Lowe's, and Walmart.
There are still a couple of days to vote in the competition to decide which of the three map jerseys becomes the Cycling Podcast jersey. They will go into production in a few weeks' time, the winning design. Choose between check, dot,
check,
and fade.
Check.
The three designs are available to see on map.cc. That's MAAP.cc. And do keep voting, because unlike the Tour de France podium, it's not set in stone just yet. A couple of days still to vote. If you vote in enough numbers for one of the two that isn't currently leading, check. Francois beat you to it. You may well be able to swing the vote at the last minute and do a kind of 2020 La Planche de Belfi last minute change of result. All of the people who voted will be entered into a draw to win a complete set of the Cycling Podcast map collection, which is obviously the jersey and the casquette and the bidon. So go to map.cc to vote for your favourite. Francois, you can only vote once, so your multiple votes for Czech are only being counted once, you know.
Well, I've created multiple accounts, you know, so I'm still pretty confident that my team will help me through to victory in this competition.
François Thomaso, Thomas Françoiso.
That's exactly.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Good. We'll keep an eye out for that. Now, what about Jonas Vingegaard then? Because second in the Tour last year and a surprise, and a distant second at that, really. But this season, he's been, well, exceptional. All the way through, he won the Drôme Classic one-day race back at the end of February. He was second overall at Tirreno Adriatico, sixth overall at Itzulia in the Basque Country, and then he was second behind his teammate Primoz Roglic at the Critérium du Dauphiné. And before the Tour, we were talking about how he was the decoy. Roglic was the leader, and Vingegaard was going to be the kind of the support, perhaps the last man in the mountains, doing the Wout van Aert, Sepp Kuss type work. But it's not worked out that way. Roglic, of course, had his problems in the early part of the race, crashed and is no longer in the race, of course. But Vingegaard has been a convincing rider so far, hasn't he? I mean, he hasn't really put a foot wrong. And as I've said the last couple of nights, the key has been that as soon as Pogacar moves, he's ready to react.
It's funny how Tour de France winners, I mean, he hasn't won it yet, but he's about to probably, are authoritative. They display a kind of trust and confidence. As we saw today, Jonas Vingegaard almost crashed. Tadej Pogacar did crash, and that's what makes the difference between a Tour de France winner and a runner-up. I mean, there was never a moment. Well, there were moments of panic when he crashed in the cobbles, or his second crash when he was changing bikes was a little bit hectic. But when it mattered in the big moments of this Tour de France, especially in the mountains, there was never a moment when you had the impression he was in trouble, or he was worried, or he was losing his self-confidence, or losing his way, or losing his line. In the descents today, he was kind of teasing the other riders in the GC group by taking shorter lines. I mean, everything. Within the way he rode, reflected this authority, this stamp of authority he has on the race, and that's remarkable, because within a year from last year, he was always, you remember, with this 1-2-3 race with Pogacar leading the way, Carapaz trying as best as he could, and Vingegaard being like Pogacar's shadow and nothing else. This year he was really, really different. You could tell it gone up a gear. He had matured, and that's what makes Tour de France winners so different. For 3 weeks, they managed to maintain a level of perfection that's flawless.
I mean, it's been a meteoric rise as well. This is only his third Grand Tour. He made his Grand Tour debut at the Vuelta in 2020 when he caught the eye doing a lot of the kind of Sepp Kuss work, didn't he, for Primoz Roglic. And then last year, of course, was the surprise package of the Tour. But as I say, 5 minutes down, never really in contention for the overall win. But this year, more or less everything has gone right for him. And well, tonight he has the yellow jersey, of course, but he also has the polka dot jersey. I have to feel for Simon Geschke a little bit, because he's turned himself inside out in recent days, trying to get as many points as possible, now too far behind to prevent Vingegaard from winning the polka dot jersey. But there's a link between, this is a tenuous link, Francois, I wonder if you're going to like this, but there's a link between Fish, Vingegaard and the polka dot jersey. Right, because Vingegaard used to work in a fish market in Denmark. He used to get up at the crack of dawn, before dawn, in fact, and go and work the early shift in the fish market, packaging fish. According to Brian Holm, another Dane, he said that's the kind of tough work that makes cycling seem like, it's not work at all, which, of course, it isn't really, is it? He's now in the polka dot jersey, which is sponsored by the Leclerc supermarket chain. And last night in our restaurant at Le Viscos, Francois, we were visited at our table by a fellow diner, the owner and boss of the Leclerc supermarket. What was his name?
Michel-Edouard Leclerc. He's pretty famous and popular in France, because he is, of course, it is all it is publicity, advertising, but he's very often on TV, claiming that, prices are too high, and that if you go to the Leclerc supermarkets, you get the real prices. And in this age of, rampant inflation, he's more popular than ever. And he was having dinner at a table near ours in the restaurant, because today was the big day, almost the final day for the polka dots, the KOM classification. And so he was meant to be on the podium and hand over the polka dot jersey to the current leader. That's what he did. But he came to our table, and he was introduced to me by the chef, Alexis, because we have a common passion, or should I say, it's not real passion. It happens that I've written books about many strange subjects, and I wrote a book about sardines, and as as happens, Michel-Edouard Leclerc is one of the leading collectors of tinned sardines in France. He has thousands of those tins, cans, boxes with sardines in them. So he was very happy to discuss that, and we're very happy to that I knew about it, and so I knew a little bit about it because I wrote a book about it. But he confirmed what I knew from writing this book, that if you have tin sardines at home and they're good quality, it's like good wine. You can keep them for decades, 20 or 30 years, and the longer you keep them, the better they are.
Well, indeed.
You know something about it.
Yeah, my dad collected tin sardines, mainly Portuguese ones, and they mature in the can. As long as they're only in olive oil and they haven't been flavoured with other things, if they've got, I don't know, chilies in or whatever, then, you know, that can become too overpowering over time or taint the flavour. But yeah, my dad had a collection. It numbers probably a dozens of tins. We found out from Mr. Leclerc, his collection, modest collection of tinned fish, 6,000 cans, he said. So, I did wonder whether that includes the ones that are in his supermarkets, but I didn't want to ask.
Yeah, well, the thing, I don't know, of course, but, he said he made it very clear that, you know, it was a very innocent hobby, and in spite of everything, he was not a rich man.
No.
You know, and when he left the table, and it was really very kind and very nice. We made a quick check on our mobile phones, about his fortune, and it's actually estimated around $2 billion. So I think for a poor guy, is not bad. Once again, a very entertaining moment.
It was, and I wish I'd picked him up on something about the polka dot jersey, because since Leclerc started sponsoring it, the dots have become smaller and more uniform. They're in rows like a game of Connect Four. I prefer the bigger dots that were more kind of irregular. I guess they're trying to put their stamp on the polka dot jersey, but for me it doesn't look as elegant as the previous designs. That's a small quibble, a stylistic quibble, but Jumbo-Visma look like they're going to take the yellow jersey, the green jersey and the polka dot jersey, and I'm sure there'll be, well, maybe your stat man will tell you, Francois, somebody's bound to know this, but I've had a little look back in the records. I can't see a team that's taken all three jerseys since all three classifications since Eddie Merckx in 1969, when he won yellow, green and the King of the Mountains. But bear in mind, back in 69, it wasn't a polka dot jersey. I think it was just a plain white jersey back then for the King of the Mountains.
Didn't Pogacar in his first Tour de France victory will win all jerseys? Or
didn't win the green jersey.
I didn't win the green, you're right.
The yellow, the polka dot,
that's
and the
right.
White.
Yep.
Going back to Bjarne Riis again, in 96, Bjarne Riis of Telecom and Erik Zabel, well, Riis won yellow, Zabel won green, and the following year they did it again. Jan Ullrich won yellow, Zabel won green. And Sunweb in 2017 won the green with Michael Matthews and the King of the Mountains with Warren Barguil, but obviously no yellow jersey. So Jumbo-Visma really have cleaned up. They came in to try and take both yellow and green, and it does look very much like they're going to do that.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2022 Tour de France. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the cycling podcast. Francois, just tucking into some energy ham. Not made by Science in Sport, but giving you some crucial energy at the end of the day, replacing all of the salts that you've lost. If you are riding in the heat at the moment, you probably want to use the Hydro range, the tablets that can help you keep hydrated before and during rides. And the Beta Fuel, if you're doing a big ride, you want to stock up on carbohydrate. But Science in Sport has everything you need for before, during and after your ride. Go to scienceinsport.com, and if you use the discount code SISCP25, you can get 25% off. Francois, you were down at the team buses a little bit earlier on this evening, and, well, you're at the Jumbo-Visma bus, because I guess they were keeping a lid on their celebrations, because there are still 3 days to go. The Tour de France is unpredictable, as much as the pattern looks set now. But what was the mood like round the bus?
It's funny, because it was not like they didn't fall in each other's arms, as you see from time to time. They probably did that up the mountain, and they had the time to ride back to the buses and time to reflect on it. Obviously, you could tell there was more a sense of relief than a sense of exaltation. They were really, job done, and really a sense of accomplishment, a sense of achievement. I listened a bit to Nathan van Hooijdonk, who was talking to our Dutch colleagues, and I talked to Tish Benoot, one of the Belgian teammates who also played his role in the mix today. Christophe Laporte came in as well. Yeah, so we'll listen maybe to Tish Benoot and about the teamwork and what it means to be in the winning team on the Tour de France. And later, I mean, Grishka Nierman, which is one of the team directors, well, really is a pleasure for us journalists to talk to, because he says everything you expect him to say about, you know, the way the day unfolded, the tactics, the strategy, and looking ahead to the end of the tour, and, you know, staying cautious, because no DS in the history of the Tour de France will tell you they've won 3 days before Paris.
I won't say we are sure after today, but we are for sure a big step closer. Jonas was really confident already all week. Also yesterday he said he was really not on the limit, so yeah, that gives confidence also for us.
Team performance today was absolutely amazing. You played a part in it.
Yesterday we knew they wanted to try the same today. It was easy to predict, so it would have been best to have one or two guys in the break, and Wout and me were in. We also could help in the final. And that made a difference for Sepp and for Jonas. They could save a bit longer, yeah.
When you reached the finish and you knew Jonas had won the stage and had written, his gap had increased, was it a relief and a joy, I suppose, but a relief as well?
Yeah, for sure. If you're working for it as a teammate, it's always nice when your leader can win. And especially if it's in the Tour de France, I would say, yeah, it's the biggest race in the world. So, yeah, for sure.
How do you see the rest of the tour now? The three big stages left. Maybe more success for Jumbo Visma.
Yeah, maybe Wout can win one or two stages more. We will see. But tomorrow, for sure, we have to stay really attentive. Don't celebrate too much tonight, because tomorrow will be a tricky one, I think.
Feel good. We are on the right track, but we still have 3 days to go. So it's not that we have a party now for 3 days. We will work concentrated like we did for the last 3 weeks. And there's another day tomorrow, and we are in the perfect position now for winning yellow and green. And we have to work a few more days, and then hopefully the dream does come true.
Textbook performance by Jumbo Visma today. Yesterday was Brandon McNulty's day, and today you were actually, well, flawless performance.
Yeah, we had a tactical plan. This basically panned out like we wanted to have it, but it's of course the riders that have to do it, that have to have the legs to actually do the plan on the road. And sums up to them, great performance of all six. And we wanted it exactly to go like that. But you can have a very good tactical plan. If the riders are not good enough or something happens, then the plan is not working out.
Was the plan also for Jonas to win the stage?
Not necessarily. For us, it would have also been okay if the stage would have gone to the breakaway. But yeah, we were confident that he could win this stage. And also he said yesterday that I think I can win the stage. So in the end, it's also a bonus.
Wout van Aert, is he a normal human being? Or is he something exceptional? Again, today was amazing.
Yeah, we call him the Green Monster, and he had a bit lesser day yesterday. He was not happy with his own performance yesterday, today we wanted him to be in the break. Now I think you saw that at kilometer zero he attacked straight away and went solo. Sometimes he's a bit over enthusiastic then, but eventually he ended up in the break, and he was there on the last climb, and he made the difference for Jonas to drop Pogacar, and he's just a great champion. Jonas could have done that probably also as well, and also, I mean, don't forget the other guys. Christophe rode a lot in the beginning, Nathan was pacing over the Obisque, Tish was pacing on the descent to get Sepp back, and on the start of the climb then Sepp did a tremendous pull on the Haute Cam, and they were only left, only Pogacar and Jonas were left, and then at the moment Sepp was finished, Wout was there, so yeah, that was just perfect, and Wout did the last pull to finish it off, and then there was a gap, and then Jonas had to continue to the finish, and I think it's a real team performance, and everybody of these six guys deserve a big compliments. Yeah, of course we're feeling confident with this lead, we're feeling confident, but there's a hard stage tomorrow coming, there will be some crosswind, tricky final, then there's a really, really hard time trial. I mean, a lot of things can happen, but of course we are confident always, but we're not going to celebrate now.
Well, that was Tish Benoot, who again looked very impressive on the climbs. Such a unique style as well, hasn't he? He's got the sort of the coat hanger shoulders and the hunched back. Looks like a sort of, you know, the offshoot of Fausto Coppi in a way, doesn't he? And he's climbing extremely well. Normally you would think of him as a classics man, but he's been a revelation in this Tour de France. And then Grisha Nierman, who's one of the people calling the shots from the team car. So Tadej Pogacar, his reign as Tour de France champion is over. Geraint Thomas has pretty much cemented third place today, hasn't he? I mean, too far away from Pogacar to think about second, I would have thought, in the time trial, but well clear of Godu, who's not really a noted time trialist. Thomas was warming down on the time trial bike outside the Ineos Grenadiers bus, and I had a chat with Rod Ellingworth just after the finish, and he was actually saying that Thomas's numbers are better and more consistent than 4 years ago when he won the Tour de France. So that gives some idea of the level that Vingegaard and Pogacar are at. They're obviously very happy with the way Thomas has ridden in this Tour, because quietly he came in here with perhaps a, you know, an outside shout of the podium. You know, the impressive win at the Tour de Suisse was, you know, there was a little question mark about that because so many riders are pulled out with COVID. But he's ridden a very good race. And Francois, you called it from the start.
Well, I'm very happy, by the way, he rode, and we thought that at his age and with his experience, he would be content with, you know, climbing and riding the Tour at his own pace, and, you know, stayed at his place, which is at this third position, which is a kind of a bronze medal in the Tour de France. But today, in the climb to Hautacam, he attacked, you know, at the front of the yellow jersey group. There he was, Garin, going for it, and I think that was great. I mean, we all know he's got his own sense of humor. I saw his move as much as a trait of humor in a way, knowing that he probably wouldn't go far, but also a kind of assertion, you know, affirmation that, you know, I am not here just for the fun, and I'm also part of the action of the fight taking place. I'm not just, you know, riding my own Tour de France, regardless of what's going on around me. I'm part of it. I'm part of the battle. I'm part of the fight. I mean, this is exciting. It's fireworks. You know, people attack from everywhere. Why not me? And he did. Of course, he didn't go far. But I mean, the simple fact that he tried and went for it.
A very impressive ride from Thomas. I do wonder whether Ineos Grenadiers played their hand quite as smartly as perhaps they could. But clearly, I mean, Adam Yates yesterday, you know, he was off the back. He clawed his way back in and then was dropped more or less immediately again. Danny Martinez, who I think's been a little bit, you know, under par perhaps, looked pretty good today. But again, I mean, normally on paper, you would say on a climb like Hautacam, you know, as a former mountain stage winner of the Tour de France, Martinez should have been a match for Van Aert. But really, he was hanging on, wasn't he? And then when the pace lifted again, that was his chance turned to dust. But I also gather from Rod Ellingworth, they're extremely pleased with how Tom Pidcock has ridden since the Alpe d'Huez stage win, which in itself, I mean, I wasn't here for that, but watching at home on TV, heart in mouth at that descent before the climb to Alpe d'Huez, and then the climb itself, I mean, a real marker for the future. But I think they're as impressed, as pleased with the way he has just sort of dug in and hung around. I mean, he has lost places overall, but, you know, he's a young guy, and this is, his first experience at the pointy end of a Grand Tour. So, you know, it's kind of two ends of the spectrum for them, isn't it? Geraint Thomas coming towards the end, and Tom Pidcock bound to be a fixture and a feature of the Tour de France in, if not next year, then coming years.
Especially as, you know, the life expectancy is probably not the right expression, but of a young rider as a potential Tour de France winner is getting shorter and shorter. When Egan Bernal won the Tour, we thought, oh, he's in for 6-7 years. But then Pogacar came and we said, oh, he's going to win 7. And, well, you know, after the third, we will come maybe another time, or maybe never. And now we've got young Jonas Vingegaard. Is he going to win what? 2, 3, 4? Just one? Who knows? You know, Pidcock could be the new one. And it keeps coming. You know, this is what's exciting about cycling these days as well. We don't know what Remco Evenepoel really can do in a Grand Tour yet. If you know, if Wout van Aert decides to, you know, to lose weight and go under a 70 kilos mark, who knows what he's capable of doing? And there are probably other, you know, up and coming young riders coming on. So, yeah, Pidcock, you know, showed on this Tour de France that it'll be a factor in the future. And as you said, Sometimes, you know, I had great hopes in this Ineos team. It looked really strong, dense, and at the same time varied. Like you had different profiles. I think probably Danny Martinez was not up to the level we expected him to be because he was sick, apparently. He had health issues. Others did as well. So Adam Yates, kind of disappointing, but at the same time, still within, you know, the top 10, top 15. So you can't say it's a terrible tour for him. But
yeah, and also I do think that as much as we think, you know, we've criticised Movistar when they've had three well-placed riders overall. You know, why don't you do more? Why don't you do more? It is difficult. To send Adam Yates, it's a big statement of intent. It's a, you know, it's a really flamboyant, showy move, and the criticism is, you know, it comes very easily if it doesn't work out. Cycling is, for all of the intensity and the explosivity of Vingegaard and Pogacar, really it can be quite a cautious game. You know, I mean, we saw yesterday Quintana sitting on Godu all the way and profiting and sneaking his way up the classification. You know, that's what the riders do when everyone is tired, everyone's more or less on their last legs. And I think today, certainly at the buses, looking at the riders as they came back was my first sense that just how tired they are. You know, they'll be relieved that the real big climbing is behind them and that they've just got, you know, a relatively straightforward run to Cao tomorrow, and then the time trial, and then Paris.
Yeah, in the old days, I would have put my money on a quiet day tomorrow, like, you know, at long last, a transitional stage, and because it's going to be probably very hot as well. But with the way this Tour de France has been, I can guarantee they're going to be at full speed again.
They're breakaway, fast, hard to get into it. Probably quite a big break, I would have thought. And then it will come down to whether or not any of the sprinters' teams think that their guys can get over those climbs at the end, I guess. But on the sprinters, Fabio Jakobsen, I mean, he survived yesterday by the skin of his teeth. I mean, incredible film of him coming over the line with seconds to spare. Soigneurs cheering and jumping up and down and getting him over the line. A couple of teammates there, I think it was Seneschal and Lampaert there at the line. I mean, on today's stage, they were all together at the... they were Bagioli, Honoré, Seneschal, Jakobsen, Cattaneo, Lampaert, so six quick step riders, plus Jeremy Le Croc of B&B Hotels just snuck in there. That was the little group off the back of the Gruppetto. It's 36 minutes 40 down inside the time cut by, you know, comfortably, really, almost 4 minutes inside the time cut. But Jakobsen suffering in this last week, and suffering for one reason, and that is the hope and the dream of winning on the Champs-Élysées. And Francois, you spoke to Fabio Jakobsen at the finish today.
That's the summary. No, I would say the Alps was the hardest in race pace, wattage, feeling. But that was in the middle of the tour. This is in the last week. So obviously there's a bit more fatigue in the body. I can feel that. My heart rate doesn't respond as quickly as it normally does, but that's normal. But I think the last 2-3 days, there was a physical limit on my body. It's just there. I try to keep the mind as sharp as possible. I always tell everybody that I never give up. I also have to tell myself. I feel a huge responsibility towards my teammates and the team here because they support me for the past 2.5 weeks. Like I said, I'm not gonna give up. I'm gonna push the limits. I'm healthy. I'm not sick. So why hold back? Do everything in my power to produce the best performance today, which comes down to everything, to eating, drinking, positioning, descending, climbing, and today was enough. As a sprinter without a team, you are nothing. They are as important in winning sprints as they are in me getting to the finish line in these races. So as a sprinter, you realize that these guys are all I have, and I owe everything to them. And this is teamwork. I can say that I really love them.
What do you feel now? Relief or already ambition for the next stages to come?
That is always mixed. Today I'm grateful. I'm relieved I could make the time limit. When I'm gonna turn around and enter the bus, I'm gonna put my shoulders back, my chest up a bit, and ask them what they think about tomorrow.
Well, as we've said, it's not been a kind tour for the sprinters. I mean, slim possibility tomorrow, but it's one of those days where the rouleur sprinters may have a chance, but the pure sprinters possibly won't. And so it's just a case of them getting to Paris and hoping they get a clear run at the line and don't get Wout van Aerted in the final 100 metres, which could very easily happen to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was quite moved by Fabio Jakobsen. I mean, you heard him. Mark Cavendish way across the mountains last year was also quite a moving story, quite a thrilling story. And I think for some reasons, Fabio Jakobsen was even more kind of moving, given his past, his injuries. The reason why he was here at the Tour and not Mark Cavendish, and the way he expressed himself. I mean, the gratitude he had for his teammates, and you could see he had a little kind of a glimmer in his eyes. You know, when I asked him if it was relief or ambition, you know, that he's feeling now. And you can tell that really that stage in Paris will be absolutely central and crucial, and probably the one of his... The question is always the same at the end of the tour. I mean, all the sprinters are tired. Who's still around? Who's in shape? Caleb Ewan, as we saw, kind of disappeared out of sight. Dylan Groenewegen really needs special conditions to be capable of winning a bunch sprint, which is probably more going to be Paris than Cahors. Yeah, I mean, we're back. You know, we're still in front of Otakam in the mountains. They're already, you know, back into a different terrain, and that's the tour rolling, you know, until the very end.
It is. Well, we better wrap up, actually, Francois, because we need to go and have our meal at Le Viscos. Last night was sensational. I think we all had the trout, didn't we? Delicious, light, fresh, cooked but cold trout with spirals of cucumber and a lemon-lime sorbet. I mean, so light, delicate, fresh. It didn't really feel like eating, did it? It was just so light on the tongue. And then the pigeon afterwards was also not too heavy. The sauce was rich, but there wasn't too much of it. It was delicious. And well, we'll go and see what delights Le Viscos has for us this evening.
I'm afraid it's going to be, from my tips from the chef, point to a little kind of less light dinner tonight, but we'll see what we get.
Ah, okay. We've been tipped off, have we? Okay, well, we'll report on that tomorrow. And well, before we go, it's time for the daily Tour de Buffalo, remembering Richard Moore. And we've talked about Paris. It's only a few days away now. And of course, that will be the start of the Tour de France Femme. The first stage will be in Paris before the men's stage finishes in the evening. The women will kick off their race, and it will go all the way to La Super Planche de Belfie on Sunday the 31st of July. And well, Richard has championed coverage of women's cycling. He was the driving force behind the cycling podcast Féminin, which took its name, of course, from the Tour Féminin from the 1980s. And every year he would make an episode of Kilometre Zero at La Course. And this is from the 2018 edition. Richard, Orla Chenoui and Rose Manley covering La Course.
The Tour du Buffalo, remembering Richard Moore.
So we're at the finish, this beautiful meadow at the finish here. It's a familiar finish to stages of the Tour de France at Le Grand Bornand. And we're watching the women's race on the big screen here, a decent crowd. And we're watching a really, really good race, it has to be said. On the Col de Rome, Cecilie Uttrup-Ludwig, who's just ridden a very good Giro, she attacked, and she's a dangerous rider. She was allowed to go. Her teammate Ashley Moulman-Passio was in the chasing group behind, and we've been watching as Uttrup-Ludwig has been grinding out, a minute, almost a minute and a half at one point, and the Michelin Scott riders Amanda Spratt and Annemiek van Vleuten have been taking it in turns to attack, with Ashley Moulman-Passio very attentive and very strong looking. So Cervelo Bigla are playing a bit of a blinder here by the looks of things.
Yeah, look, I mean, it was a bit of a surprise move from Cecily, I think. She's always been
Follower.
Yeah, a bit of a follower, but also she's... I mean, she attacks plenty, but it normally doesn't come to much, really. She's Ashley Moulman's right-hand woman. I mean, she is always there for Ashley in the mountains. And we can see that now there's a group of four, basically, of all of the kind of favourites, all the people that we thought were going to be there are there. So I think it's probably will be time up for Cecily on this final climb. But
well, will it? We'll see. I mean, what's interesting is that team, Savella Bigla, is very much Sashi Mumpasio's team, isn't it? And when I spoke to her earlier this year, I got the impression that she wanted a bit more aggression from some of her teammates, Cecilia in particular. She's a great young rider. She was best young rider in the Women's World Tour last year, and probably, you know, knocking on the door of a big result. And, you know, she's still got 50 seconds, and she's really not far from the summit now of the Col de la Colombière, and then it's a descent down here into the finish.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Hi, I'm Angie Hicks, co-founder of Angie, and one thing I've learned is that you buy a house, but you make it a home. Because with every fix, update, and renovation, it becomes a little more your own. So you need all your jobs done well. For nearly 30 years, Angie has helped millions of homeowners hire skilled pros for the projects that matter, from plumbing to electrical, roof repair to deck upgrades. So leave it to the pros who will get your jobs done well. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find a pro for your project at Angie.com.
It's 10:01 a.m. on a Monday, all at once. Your sales leader needs to know which deals are at risk. Your PM wants feature adoption by cohort, and your CFO needs one last graph for the board. Now your data team has to say no to somebody. Hex changes that. Ask any data question in plain English and get an analyst-grade response, all backed by your actual business context as defined by your data team. Start saying yes to more data questions at hex.ai.
Over time, moss, mold, and mildew stains cover your home, and cleaning them is too much work. You need Wet and Forget, the easy bleach-free way to clean tough outdoor stains. For decks, patios, and cushions, use Wet and Forget outdoor spaces. No scrubbing, no rinsing. Just apply and let it do the work for you over time. Got a bigger job? Reach second-story siding and roofs with Outdoor Max. Up to a 30-foot reach and 2 times the coverage. Get Wet and Forget at Home Depot, Lowe's, and Walmart.